Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental or additional
to the main topic.
The main topic in the margin of a book.
Author John Burnham Schwartz has 6 novels under his belt. He's written extensively for the screen and television, and he was nominated for the 2018 Writers Guild of America Award. His subject matter varies, and he's not a stranger to historical fiction. What is new this time around is his family connection to the subject matter. The Red Daughter by John Burnham Schwartz is the story of the only daughter of Joseph Stalin, Svetlana Aleluyeva, who defected to the United States in 1967. And that's where John's family comes into the picture. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. The Red Daughter is the story of Svetlana Aleluyeva, and she's the only daughter of Joseph Stalin. She defected to the United States in 1967.
Yes.
Her young lawyer traveled under CIA cover to escort her safely to the United States, and so far everything that I've said is fact, and in fact that young lawyer was your father. But the Red Daughter isn't about your father, is it?
No, not exactly. I mean, so just to sort of throw everybody back in time a bit, because the Cold War is a long time ago, and I think may not be as present in everyone's mind. And Svetlana herself, though incredibly famous at the time, you know, most people probably don't know who she is. But her defection in the spring of 1967 was one of the most momentous events at the height of the Cold War in 1967. She remains to this day the most important Soviet citizen ever to defect to the West. And when she arrived at JFK for the first time in the United States, there were more reporters waiting for her plane than had been there for the Beatles 3 years earlier. That's how insane it was. But if you jump ahead, you know, almost 45 years, just going back to where this book came from. So it's November 2011, and I'm in my house here in Brooklyn. And I pick up the New York Times, and there on the front page, I see the headline, Lana Peters, Stalin's daughter, dead at 85. So I start reading the obituary, and the obituary writer tells me, you know, right off the bat, that the life of Joseph Stalin's daughter reads like a Russian novel. So I'm intrigued, and as I read it, you know, I find it's absolutely true. Her life seems extraordinary. And then inside, as I'm on the next page, I come to a photograph, and the hair on my arm stands up because I recognize the picture, and I recognize the two people in the picture, and it's Svetlana, and it's my dad, who looks very young. He's 34 years old. The picture was taken that day in April 1967 at JFK when she landed for the first time. And she's smiling, she's attractive and charismatic, and she's surrounded by microphones. And my dad's smiling, too. He was the lawyer that the CIA sent to Zurich under a false passport in the middle of the night to secretly bring her into the United States. She had been hiding there in a convent under heavy security for weeks, under threat of assassination from the Soviet Union, waiting to see if the United States would, in fact, accept her, which is something that most people in the government did not want to do because they did not want to antagonize the Soviet Union at a time when, you know, nuclear annihilation between the two nations seemed like a legitimate fear. And by the time that flight was over and my father and Svetlana arrived, they had been traveling under the names of Mr. and Mrs. Stalin, false passports, as a married couple. He was the closest person to her in her new country. And for the next 10 years that she was there, as she embarked on this crazy new journey, he was her lawyer, her closest advisor and her friend. And she actually spent almost a month with us that first summer on Nantucket in our house. And she often stayed with us over the next years when I was, so I was two that first year, and I would see her as a child. And that photograph that I saw in the obituary, I also recognized it because it was a photograph that was on the wall of our house for years when I was growing up. And then over the decades, as my father moved from one law office to another, he just retired last year at 86, I saw that same photograph in his office. He carried it with him all through the years. It's, in fact, in the office in his house right now out in Los Angeles. So after reading that obituary and seeing that photograph, I started work on the Red Daughter the next morning. Svetlana Stalina, which was the name she was born with, was the daughter of a man responsible for the death of more than 20 million of his own people, one of the most brutal tyrants in history. And she would spend her entire life trying to find a home and trying to show the world and herself that she was not her father. And I think it's safe to say she would never succeed, never did succeed, but she never stopped trying. And to me, that lifelong effort, desperate though it may have been, and foolhardy though it may have been, holds its own kind of wonder. And that's what made me want to write the book. So she's named Svetlana, and most of the historical figures have their own names. They're all dead now. I gave the lawyer in the book a different name because I knew I wanted to make my own character. And I also knew that the role that the lawyer, named Peter Horvath in the novel, he would take on a far greater role in her life over time, and in fact become a romantic involvement in her life for decades in a way that absolutely had nothing to do with the eventual relationship my father had with Svetlana. Obviously, they had no romantic relationship in real life. She was a very difficult, challenging person, to say the least. And by the mid-70s, he was no longer representing her and was not very involved in her life at all after that, though he would continue to receive letters from her for decades. Even my mother received letters from her many years later. She was that sort of person. She never let go of things, exactly. But anyway, that's how the whole novel came to start. Some years ago now, I will say, now that we're here.
Well, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the way you've been able to weave together fact and fiction, but also a little bit about structure. Some of the letters you used in the book between Stalin and Svetlana were real, right?
Yes, they're short, but I began reading, I wanted to read everything I could about her. And that involves three memoirs that she wrote in her life. One memoir, by far the best, she wrote in 1963 in Russian. And she carried that with her into the United States. And that, in fact, was the currency, in a sense, that allowed her to be accepted here. My father helped arrange a publishing deal for that memoir. That was the largest publishing deal for a memoir other than Churchill's memoirs ever. It was $1.5 million for the worldwide rights at that time in 1967. So that was an immense amount of money. She would end up losing all of that money, but that's another story. So there was that memoir. There was another one a couple of years after she arrived in the States, less good, more obsessed in a way with certain things that were being done to her. And then there was a third one many years later, around the time that, believe it or not, she re-defected to the Soviet Union for 2 years, dragging with her her American teenage child. But again, that's later in the book. And then there was a very good biography of her written about 4 years ago. There were many other books about Stalin, histories by Simon Sebag, Montefiore, and others. I did all the reading I could possibly do and loved doing it. And my father had very generously shared with me a huge file he had going back decades of all of his correspondence with her and documents of that kind. There were letters between them, and there were also documents like a CIA psychological profile that was done of her in the embassy in New Delhi when she defected. which I don't know anybody who's seen that. It was fascinating. I use part of that in the book. I use little small letters between Stalin and Svetlana when she was a child after her mother had committed suicide and her father was her only parent. And though he was away much of the time, they had a very tender relationship during those years. And those letters captured a kind of intimacy, almost an innocence between them that, to me, felt so pure. I wanted them in the book for their kind of radioactive emotional properties that I thought would spread throughout the novel in some way as to what they had meant to her when she was a child versus what happened to her later and what she came to know. And there are some letters between her and her children. She left two nearly adult children in the Soviet Union when she defected, a sign certainly that it was not a planned act on her part, at least not planned in advance. I think she left on a trip to India for the only trip that she'd ever had outside the Soviet Union, and I think she genuinely expected to be home in 2 weeks when she left. And there are letters of little things of that sort and a couple of small newspaper clippings and things of that sort. So I wanted those there just for the, as I said, the kind of the more, less for the historical aspect than for the sort of emotional qualities that they gave off, that I didn't feel that my recreating those would add anything. Whereas all the architecture around that, obviously, I was fictionalizing in many ways, though I think if you do the history that I did, you'll find actual facts all on every single page, everywhere you turn. But that's sort of my approach to historical fiction, I would say. I think everyone who writes historical fiction, and this is my second such novel, has a kind of philosophy, if you will, about what they're after. And I would say that mine, you know, put very simply, is to not have the seams show, so that you would be both surprised to find how much of it actually happened, and you would also be surprised to find what of it didn't. And I often use actual historical details as an entry point into a scene that allows me to step into that scene and imagine it somewhat differently, but based on what everything I know about that character and how she might be feeling and reacting.
Was the imaginary friend slash enemy real?
Yes, there's a Lyoka is this little friend that her father wrote about, would tell her he created this doppelganger for her, which is kind of cruel if you really think about it. A little girl who was sort of perfect in every way. And he would say, well, you know, why aren't you like Lyoka, or have you seen Lyoka today? And Svetlana secretly, of course, hated Lyoka. And yes, so that sort of thing, I mean, that's, I love doing research as a novelist, I must say. I love getting my head around every single detail, but really I'm drawn to things that to me seem to have the most emotional, psychological residue on, in this case, on Svetlana, on the person I want to know about. So that the historical, I'm looking at it less as a detailed historical mapping and more as an emotional mapping. And so the moment I read about Lyoka, of course, I mean, I just immediately, my pulse went up a good number of notches, and I immediately knew. And that's what it's like to do research as a novelist, I find. You want to know everything, but the truth is, you want to make spaces for discovery of the character and for actual emotional reaction and engagement. And in order to do that, you have to excavate some of the details and facts. And so, but at the same time, the fact itself becomes, as I said before, a doorway. It allows you to say, oh my goodness, there's a window or a door, and I want to get through it, and I want to know what's in there. And then you have to step in and you have to imagine it based on everything you know about that life at this point. So that's part of the fun of it.
The book is told from oscillating perspectives through the journals of Svetlana, through letters between both Svetlana and Peter, and then also through the editor's notes of her lawyer, Peter Horvath. And I understand that you didn't structure it that way initially. Were you thinking about doing footnotes? Is that right?
Yes, I was, which is, you know, it sounds even worse in retrospect, right? I mean, my editor, thankfully, dissuaded me. It was a little too Nabokovian, you know, with the footnotes and the slightly professorial commentary. It's also just really hard to read, you know, your eyes going up and down. But the structure took me really almost 2 years to figure out, and I think there were a couple of reasons for that. I wanted the intimacy of her voice. I mean, honestly, one of the reasons, along with, you know, that experience I told you of seeing the photograph in the paper, one of the reasons that made me want to write this novel is that I felt reading all of her letters and her manuscripts, especially in the second half of her life when she expressed herself more and more in English, both in written terms and verbally. And her voice became, she was a very intelligent woman, but her voice became more and more, it seemed to me, like a fist that kept tightening. More and more words in her letters would be capitalized and underlined several times, exclamation marks. You know, there was a kind of primitive fierceness to her thinking, and also she would be very emotional and warm sometimes, and then other times her sense of being a victim or being victimized or conspiracies that were around would come in. And so there was a kind of reductive quality to this that I felt wasn't commensurate in a way with the incredible just arc and complexity of her life, the idea of who she was born to, what happened in her early years, how she grew up, and what she ended up doing. And so I felt that even with a very good biography written about her by Rosemary Sullivan called Stalin's Daughter, published 4 years ago, I of course devoured it. But at the same time, I almost felt sorry for the biographer because in the end, she was still yoked to that voice of Svetlana's. And I wanted a voice that had a little more flexibility to it, if you will, a little more range, emotionally and perceptively. And so I began to think about the journals. Now, these journals that I wrote, the journals of Svetlana Aleluyeva from 1967 to 2011, are fictional. They don't exist as far as I know. And the voice that I write them in is my voice for her. But then at the same time, as I said, she's such a complex, challenging, and at times difficult person, especially as she gets older and that voice begins to change, that I knew all along that we would need, the reader and even I, would need a different perspective on her in order to fully be able to sympathize with her, which is a little different from saying you like her all the time. You don't. You like her sometimes, and sometimes you find her difficult. But in order to truly sympathize with her and with her life, I wanted another perspective. And that's where Peter Horvath comes in, and that's where the idea of the role my father played, but then taking that role and extrapolating it into the role of somebody who not only brings her into this country and becomes incredibly close to her, but actually falls in love with her, and with whom ultimately she too has a love, even though it's obviously not, as if you read the book, you realize it's not a simple love, not even in normal terms a successful love, but they are the people who are closest to each other over those decades, all the way to the end. And so I created these chapters, begins with an editor's foreword with Peter, in which he explains that these journals arrived on his doorstep weeks after he heard about her death. And obviously, he's mourning her. These journals that he never had seen before arrive. They're in Russian. It takes him a year to get them translated. And now what we're seeing is a sort of product, a publishing product, if you will, that he has been tasked to do, which is to edit these journals and put them together, and his commentary comes in places throughout the book. But unlike a normal editor, he's not really the editor, he's a participant, because her story also tells his story to some degree, and his story tells her story. And so it allows a window onto her, and I think for herself as well, to be able to see herself a little better. It allows the reader, I hope, to be able to sympathize with her in a way, you know, we couldn't otherwise. And it also becomes a kind of backdoor autobiography for Peter himself that he never would have written otherwise. Something that at first he's not aware of doing, and then later he is, that allows his life to be fuller than it was, and for him to take full stock of his feelings for her and what she meant to him and what she meant to everybody in a way. And, you know, she was the most exciting thing that ever happened to him. And she saw him in a way that his wife never did, other people never did. And he saw her in a way that no one else ever did either. And so that runs through the whole book, and I hope gives it an emotional, sympathetic quality that otherwise wouldn't have been possible.
Was it difficult to write from those two perspectives? I mean, one whose first language was not English, and she had, you know, a very intense life. And then there was a different intensity behind Peter's writing. I mean, I would mark places like when Peter met the CIA guy, Dick Thompson, and Peter wrote, after a minute or two of small talk, his internal timer went off and he got down to business. Or when he described his commute with this sentence, the train rocked a couple of times and began, as though embarrassed by itself, to drift forward for a few crossrails thumping under the cars. So, I mean, how was it to write from the two perspectives? I mean, did you have to shift gears while writing?
Interesting question. You know, I mean, I've actually, a number of my books, so this is my sixth novel, and going back to Reservation Road, my second novel, which is told in three alternating points of view, and then Northwest Corner, which picks up some of the characters from that, you know, a dozen years later, that has five different points of view. My novel, The Commoner, which is my previous historical novel, is based on the lives of the Empress and Crown Princess of Japan. Now their roles are somewhat reversed since the Emperor just abdicated yesterday. And so that's told in the voice of a fictional Japanese empress. I mean, over 70 years. I know it's crazy, but there it is. And even in my novel, Claire Marvel, there's a whole section in the voice of an older French woman. And so, you know, I don't want to psychoanalyze myself too much, but I have not only, I think, a comfort in telling these different perspectives and shifting from them. But in fact, it excites me. It actually activates my imagination, I find, in a way that it allows me, too, to shift and see things differently. And linguistically, it's just a pleasure to be able to write in different registers, you know. And oftentimes, it may be the character who's obviously more like me that's a greater stretch for me in a weird way. Peter Horvath, obviously, in some ways, is more like me than Svetlana. But I never, from the beginning, I never felt any anxiety about inhabiting Svetlana's voice as I came to find it. Now, it does change through the book, and that was something I was aware of and I wanted. But I sort of felt the same thing when I was writing The Empress of Japan. I don't know what it says about me, except that I, you know, like so many writers, fiction writers, I do enjoy living other people's lives and seeing the life through other people, but it's also, I think, to some degree, to me, a testament of how we're all the same, you know, and that's part of the universal quality that we're looking for. That said, technically speaking, I remember when I was writing Reservation Road way back when. I was published 20 years ago, and that book took me 6 years, and shifting voices when I was at that point in my career was brutal. I mean, I would finish one chapter, and then I would lose days just trying to mentally shift my mind, and I got to the point where I would write all the chapters in one character. I'd do about 5 or 10 in a row. They're short chapters generally. And then just so I could get some continuity, and then I'd switch. I don't do that anymore. I don't need to do it. I just work a little bit differently, and maybe it's because as we get older, you know, we become repositories of more voices ourselves, and we're a little more capacious that way in terms of our experience.
I kept finding myself marking Peter's sentences, and I don't know if I was just impressed with their structure or if I would just, like, do a little sigh afterward, but when I was flipping through, I kept finding my markers were in Peter's.
I appreciate that. You know, I think he will certainly go less noticed than Svetlana as the book gets out there. He's a quieter character, and there's less of him in the book. But you know, I worked hard toward the end. I had to make him less passive over the drafts of the novel, just as I tried to find ways of making Svetlana perhaps more sympathetic over the drafts of the novel. But Peter was someone who I found in the writing, and maybe this is representative by the idea of going from footnotes to actual chapters. He was growing, literally. But I had to find ways of helping him grow into his own voice and a sense that his own life mattered in this story, not just to him. And so, you know, and he had his own journey and his own mistakes as well. But in the end, I think, you know, he had to grow too. Otherwise, there's no reason for him to be telling this story. And so that was, you know, that's one of the satisfactions. Structure, of course, is such an important thing in a book, and you have to really put in the time to try and make it a structure that organically makes sense for the characters and for that particular story. And so when I finally got to that with this book, that was satisfying and gave me great confidence. The book still took another few years. So it's not like it was all gravy after that.
You know, Peter, he describes learning about Svetlana from her second language, English, and how it could never possibly show the whole of her. And I found that very insightful. And I remember visiting with an author about his book, which he wrote in Spanish, and it was translated into English. But our discussion was in English. But the words we were discussing weren't his words. And so I guess I'm wondering, is there a greater takeaway here? I mean, lost in translation seems so innocuous, but lack of understanding less so.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm fascinated by translation for a number of reasons. My stepfather was the great poet W.S. Merwin, who died. He was a remarkable man, and I was deeply lucky to have him in my life for so long. But William was a great translator, and he believed in translation, and he often also translated writers like Mandelstam, you know, who wrote in languages that he didn't himself speak. So there were cases where he, as with Mandelstam, he would work with a translator, a literal translator, someone he trusted, and then he would take that literal translation and he would consider it as poetry, and he would begin to make it into the poetry in the vein of all that he knew about the poetry of that writer. And that was his idea of what translation amounted to. And of course, I've had my work translated into many languages, only a couple of which I actually can read. And there is this feeling of sometimes almost fear, like you really don't know what they're saying about you. And then even when you're reading a language you know, like French or Italian, where you see the ways in which it does not exactly represent sometimes what you meant. And it does. It brings you back on it. It makes you think. And it really made me think, in this case, about Svetlana, having this whole idea that we're reading her journals, which were written in Russian, which then had to be translated for Peter in order to be able to read them. It just made me think again about her life as an immigrant and what that meant and how she saw and had to see this place and what she missed about it also, what she couldn't see, and how she got things wrong sometimes or wasn't understood. And that became, I mean, you're absolutely right, it became a kind of undercurrent for the structure of the book and for the very nature of the book. And I appreciate that. I don't know that I'll get that question very often. But I think about translation a lot for those reasons. And at the same time, we want to keep translating, right? We want more of it. You know, we don't want less of it. It's more like the way the world is now. But it brings its complications, and we have to factor that into our sympathies and our understanding.
In one of Svetlana's letters, which I assume you wrote, it had this statement: "Governments will always lie. It is the job of artists and intellectuals to tell the truth." Were those your words or hers?
I'm quite sure those are mine.
Can you talk to me about that?
They very much represent ideas that she has spoken in different places. I mean, though this book does not spend, it does not, as in some historical novels like Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, whatever, it doesn't attempt to capture an entire, you know, period or society in a certain period in history. It takes a much more intimate view of the events and the lives at hand. That said, she still was, and she was not in that sense highly political. That said, she defected from a regime that she did not believe in. And despite the contradictions of her later life and the changes in her mindset, the truth is she rejected it. And there were things about America that she believed in more. And that was real. I think later in her life she got more confused about it. But the truth is, it was real. And so those ideas that she had were part of what made her such a hero to so many in the West when she defected. I mean, it was an astonishing idea that the man whose will to power created the Soviet Union, I mean, Stalin, really, from the late 20s onwards, I mean, his, even after he'd been disavowed by Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956, Stalin is still the single biggest figure at the heart of Soviet mythology. In fact, there was a poll last week I read in which 70% of Russian respondents responded that they felt that Stalin's role in history was positive for the history of the Soviet Union. And so the mythological view of him not only is coming back, it's never died. And, you know, Putin is in many ways the most Stalinesque figure we've seen, his understanding of what power is. So those are her, I wanted to give that sense of her courage and also her conviction. And the fact that she's unable in her life to make the life represent that conviction in a straighter line is a sign of how confused she was as a person, you know, emotionally. The sense of abandonment and powerlessness that she inherited from her two parents. One, her mother, a suicide when she was six, and the other, her father, who is Joseph Stalin, and responsible for the death of 20 million people, which ultimately she does reckon with and has to come to accept, even though she's terrified of the fact that she can never escape the cage of his name or his blood.
You know, you blended a lot of fact with fiction, and some of the fact even seemed more unbelievable than the fiction sometimes.
That's
and
I'm
afraid I'm running out of time, so I guess I kind of want to ask you, did you discover anything about Svetlana's life that surprised you?
That's a good question. You know, reading about her attempts to be a mother another time. I mean, she left her two children in the Soviet Union, which was obviously traumatic for them and traumatic for her, and something she regretted and for the rest of her life, and tried to correct insufficiently during her redefection fiasco later on. But she had a third child in the States at the age of 45, an American child, and she was obsessed with the idea that this child would be American and would not speak Russian and would never know. In real life, it was a girl. In my book, it's a boy, to try and protect the privacy of that person who's alive and also to protect my own imagination, I guess. But she didn't. She was determined that her daughter would never know who her grandfather had been. And ultimately, she was not able to keep that information from her, and ultimately all sorts of things happened. But I was very struck by how difficult that motherhood was for her, but how much she placed on it and how desperate it made her to try and to realize that she might not be getting it right, the way we all feel, actually, with our kids sometimes. And it really struck me. And the other thing, of course, that struck me was just the arc of her life. She ends up dying in a retired assisted living home in outside of Spring Green, Wisconsin, right outside of Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright's house where she had lived during another completely astonishing, crazy 2-year period of her life, where she married Frank Lloyd Wright's son-in-law and lived in this cult-like environment under the thumb of Wright's widow for 2 years. But she dies there in obscurity, wearing hand-me-down clothes, still watching some Elizabeth Taylor movies that she had seen when she was growing up in the Kremlin, and still absolutely stubborn and kind of relentlessly pursuing this idea of that she could live in anonymity and not be Stalin's daughter. And I just was, it all surprised me, all of it, the arc of that, where she began and where she ended, and how she kept trying, you know, to find love, to know what it is, and to be her own person, even though she never completely succeeded.
That Frank Lloyd Wright stuff surprised me. I had no idea. I didn't know about the fellowship. I didn't know about any of that. So I found that fascinating.
It could be a book all on its own.
Yes.
And I actually had adapted Loving Frank as a screenplay.
Oh.
I was deep into that history already. And so when I came to that, I just couldn't believe it. Because,
oh, wow.
You know, Wright's widow was very Stalinesque. And that was a battle that Svetlana fought and lost. And, but that's how she got her American daughter.
I think during your last visit to Wichita, you told me that your father was also the lawyer and literary agent for Truman Capote. Did I make that up?
Truman's literary executor, in fact. And he was also the lawyer for Arthur Miller for many years, for Solzhenitsyn at one point, for David Halberstam. I mean, all sorts of people in literature, art, politics, in the theater, Dustin Hoffman at one point for a while. So he had a really interesting career, and I sort of told him that I was looking forward to going around the country and talking about, you know, how this book came to be for me, just because it was a way also of thinking and talking about what are what a really interesting career he had now that he's retired.
And did you discover anything about your father that took you by surprise?
No, I mean, there were some wonderful details. Well, yes, actually, that's not true. So I was about 2 years into it, and I was driving with him one day out in L.A. where he lives, and I wanted to know. I was trying to find just some details about the wedding, that when she marries Wright's son-in-law, because she married him 3 weeks after she had been sort of coaxed down there by Ogilvana Wright, who was posing as a sort of mother figure to her, which Svetlana was very vulnerable about. So she gets down there. She's set up with Wes Peters, who's his name in real life. And literally, she marries him 3 weeks later. And I was asking my dad if he knew any details about it. And he said, well, yeah, I was there. And I said, you were? And he said, of course. And it turns out he gave her hand away in marriage. He was the only representative of her at the wedding. She had called him, 2.5 weeks after getting there, and said that it's sort of rather like the little scene in the book. I mean, she says she needs him to come to Arizona, to Scottsdale, that weekend. And she won't tell him why. So, he's her lawyer and advisor, and so he gets on a plane, he goes down there. He has no idea what he's doing there. And 3 hours after he arrives, he's giving her hand away at the wedding. And he knew it wasn't going to go well, but he supported her. And, Wes Peters took most of her money over those 2 years, and a whole lot of things came out of it. But so that I was bowled over to think that he had been there. And, of course, he gave me some good details.
What does your dad think of the book?
I will say he loves it. I think he was very concerned that he was not going to. And I was very worried about that. He wasn't the only one, by the way. So in the end, after we had a lunch in which he expressed, before he'd read it, he expressed his ambivalence about the project now that he was at the end of his legal career and he just didn't know. I think he was a little worried about what the lawyer would look like or feel like to him. And, of course, the lawyer is incredibly different from him as a person. But he then called me 2 weeks later, and he just said the nicest things about it. And I'm really grateful to him for his help. I'm grateful to him for his comments. And I just feel very happy about where it's put both of us. We might do a couple of interviews together even over the course of the summer. And I think he's feeling very good about it. And I am. So I'm thankful for that.
That was John Burnham Schwartz, author of the book The Red Daughter, which was published by Random House. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at kmuw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.